Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to History Hack. It's Beth here. It's been a little while since I've been on one of these podcasts, but I'm joined by the lovely Chris Sams. Chris, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks, Beth. How are you?
I'm very good, very good. All the better for being with you as well. So, Chris, tell us who we've got on today and what we've got in store.
Today, you'll be relieved to know that I won't be forcing you to do any naval history. Instead, we have Clive Pearson, who is a historian and a lecturer who specialises in the Second World War, especially Russia's role. Today, he's here to talk to us about his latest book, Prime Ministers in 100 Facts. Clive, welcome to the podcast.
Okay, thank you.
So, from Walpole to May, we have had quite a mixed bag of personalities and backgrounds. When you were researching this book, what really caught your eye the most?
Oh, I think that actually quite a big period. I think most historians are really familiar with the 19th century prime ministers such as Gladstone, Disraeli, and of course 20th century prime ministers. But I think that in the 18th century is a bit of a grey area, really, and it's quite. I found it quite fascinating. Some of the prime ministers are really sort of some quite ne'er-do-wells, really. Sort of they just enriched themselves, and half the time they weren't there. They were either ill or having apoplectic fits, etc. But I think what was fascinating for me was the whole setup at the time, that it was rampant corruption with the corruption of the pocket boroughs, for example, which each of them presented two MPs, and basically they didn't have an electorate. So, for example, there'd be as many or as few as five electorates. So, for example, an example of this was Old Sarum near Salisbury, or another one was Dunelm on the coast, which had actually sunk into the sea. They still returned two MPs. There are about 140 of these. And and those that were returned were the king's men, and they basically supported the king and his appointments and whoever the king decided to appoint. And it's an interesting fact as well that government was decided by an election in the 18th century. So basically the reason was because the king decided who the prime minister was going to be. So a lot of the prime ministers were not really up to very much. Just a few of them really outstanding. For example, Walpole, Pitt the Elder, Pitt the Younger, that sort of thing. But it was just interesting that, you know, you had to charm the king, cozy up to the king if you wanted to keep your position. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the first two Georges, George the First, George the Second, they in fact wouldn't have any any Tories in their government, because the Tories were associated with the Jacobites. So for half of the century, it was only Whig governments. And then George III came in and he only had Tories in. So the choice of prime ministers was really not very fair at all. It just depended on the king and his likes and dislikes, basically. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was quite interesting.
I know it's not really relevant. It's probably a bit apocryphal. But when you talk about rotten boroughs, I can't help but think of Blackadder 3 and the Dunedin by-election with the only voter, Mr. E. Blackadder.
Well, the whole system was a stitch-up for the aristocracy and the king, basically. Mm. And interesting in that period as well, no prime ministers talked about reform because no one was interested in it because it was self-perpetuating and suited everybody. The system was corrupt and I just wanted to keep the system going as it was. It wasn't until 1832 the whole system was reformed, really. So about 100 years nearly of rampant corruption.
Rampant corruption in politics. That sounds awfully familiar. When we think of prime ministers, as you mentioned earlier, you said there are those names that everyone knows. So says, well, name your prime minister. You might say obvious names like Churchill, Gladstone, Disraeli, Lloyd George, Asquith. There are names that everyone knows, but arguably the ones who fade into the background are just as interesting and maybe in some cases even more interesting. And one of those that you do highlight in the book is the third Duke of Grafton. Who is he?
Oh. Well, I said in my book that Grafton was no grafter. He was typical of the period in a way, and that he was basically interested in the pleasures of life, basically. So hunting, shooting, racing. And he was the great grandson of Charles II and Barbara Villiers. And we know about Charles II and the fact that he liked lots of mistresses and liked to enjoy himself. And Grafton was very much the same, really. He had a string of mistresses. And famously, he used to parade his favourite mistress, which was Nancy Parsons, and who was such a beauty that she was painted by Joshua Reynolds. And I think he had something like 16 children as well, not with Nancy Parsons, but with a couple of wives. So basically enjoyed himself. But as prime minister, he was not really up to much. He didn't really want to be prime minister, but the king insisted. And he really didn't like, he found it irksome, the business of government. And famously, he would cancel cabinet meetings because race meetings were on, or he had friends at home, that sort of thing. So not really up to much as prime minister, but not exceptional, I would say, for the 18th century.
Sounds fairly standard behaviour for the time period.
Would it be standard behaviour for Boris as well, probably?
Well, indeed.
Says the liberal in the corner. Another one that you had that came up was William Cavendish Bentinck, who was the third Duke of Portland. He gets quite a strong historical verdict, but is it fair?
Having looked at some others who were just as reprehensible, you might say no. But the reference really was to his government in the period 1807 to 1809, when we had the Napoleonic Wars on, and he basically was not there most of the time. And you think, in the middle of a war, maybe we need a hands-on prime minister directing the war. He actually gave virtually no direction to his government. And even two of his ministers actually had a duel. He did nothing to sort these quarrels out. It was totally useless. But also, I mean, in his defence, he was pretty ill, apparently, and finally decided to throw in the towel when he had an apoplectic fit, which was, in those days, what we call now as a stroke, basically. But he was pretty useless. But there are other people in the 18th century who were also passengers in their government, like figureheads, and didn't really do very much. But I suppose in the middle of a war, perhaps you expect, you know, better behaviour, really. Or stronger characters to give direction to the war. But there we go. Perhaps not much difference to some of them.
No, absolutely. They all seem to be of a very similar ilk in that time period. again, some of these names are, you know, I hadn't heard of Cavendish Benwick, and they're not names that are familiar.
No,
but there
no,
is
no.
there is a name that is familiar, as you know, mostly due to his place, I suppose, and where he comes in the list of prime ministers, and that's Pitt the Younger. Obviously, a very interesting prime minister in all. What can you tell us about him? And
well, unique in the annals of history, because obviously the youngest prime minister ever in history, 24, which is remarkably young. And
I don't know if I'd trust a 24-year-old in the country at the moment.
And well, people didn't at the time. They thought it was hilarious. You've got Blackadder thoughts again about Pitt the embryo and all that sort of thing. But the reason for his appointment was his father, Pitt the Elder, had been a remarkable war leader. And I think the King, George III, thought, well, you know, chip off the old block, I'll give him a chance. And he was a remarkable orator. And he had been taught by his father to do simultaneous translations of Greek and Latin from a young age. And so he was a remarkable figure in Parliament, despite his young age. And the other point is that he was the second longest serving prime minister, nearly 19 years. So it's quite a long stint in office. And what was unusual about him as well is that unlike the others who were sort of enjoying the pleasures of life, shall we say, he actually devoted himself entirely to the country and to the job, basically. So, and this was particularly the case because he was very much involved in the Napoleonic Wars as well in the early days. And but he was a bachelor, and he had a strange sort of lifestyle. He was thought nothing of, you know, getting to bed about 4 o'clock in the morning. He was a night owl and enjoyed lots of parties and would speak for hours at night in Parliament. But also he was a very big drinker. His father had brought in a doctor called Anthony Addington, and Anthony Addington had recommended that the young lad was looking a bit frail and unhealthy, and he thought what he needed best was plenty of port wine every day. That would build him up. That was recommended in those days. And he was getting through, according to William Hague in his book, about a bottle and two thirds of port wine every day. Wow. So you can imagine, you can imagine that he was verging on being an alcoholic, basically.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's not surprising then that he died a relatively young age of 46. And his doctor at the time said he could have been 90 when they did the autopsy. He was sort of very much a wreck, really, basically. But he worked himself into the ground and drank himself into the ground. You wouldn't have said he was a great prime minister, however, because his achievements were very few. He wasn't a great war leader, despite the efforts that he put in. He promised to abolish the slave trade and bring in various reforms, and he did none of them. So although he's a very interesting character, you wouldn't put him up with the greats like Gladstone or even his father, Pitt the Elder, etc. So an interesting character, if nothing else, really.
Absolutely. And yeah, gosh, a bottle and two thirds every day of port.
Yes.
Gosh, well, I've done a bottle in a single day, and I know the ramifications of what that means.
Well, presumably he got hardened to it over the years. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Talking of the slave trade and tragic ends, we'll move on to Spencer Percival, who has the unfortunate moniker to be the only serving prime minister to be murdered in office. So he had quite a tragic end. But he also had a link to the role with the slave trade as well, didn't he?
Yes, well, he's had a strong evangelical Christian convictions, and sort of a bit like Gladstone, if you want, really. They coloured his thoughts and his actions in government. So he's a pretty good prime minister, actually. And probably would have gone on, to, you know, like Lord Liverpool for 17 years or whatever it was. But as you say, tragically, his life was cut short by John Bellingham. So when he was Chancellor in 1807, he was instrumental in pushing through the abolition of the slave trade, and belonged to something called, I think it was the African Institute, which and they were determined that they would stop the ships going across from West Africa. So when he was Prime Minister, he was determined to stop all ships, you know, investigate all ships that were moving across from West Africa and going towards the Caribbean and America. So, yeah, so he started that. And in fact, what we do forget is, I'll just put this in as a point, that until America stopped the slave trade, Royal Navy ships were patrolling off the coast of West Africa and saved hundreds of thousands of black people's lives. That's something we forget, actually. Although we're reprehensible for having started the slave trade, we actually did quite a lot to stop it afterwards. Mm. So I thought it was an interesting point. There is a theory that John Bellingham, who was the assassin, was put up to it by various slave traders who hated Percival, that he was, you know, supported and paid to do it. They knew he had a big grievance, and he was just the man for these merchants who really hated Percival. So it's just a theory. I'm not sure that it necessarily holds true, but this, you know, there's lots of people support this idea going through the records.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly isn't an outlandish theory, is it, that he could have been supported by those who were advocates of the slave trade? Yeah, you know, yeah, it is certainly a good, a solid theory. And then I suppose you move from Spencer Percival, who in that period of time, as we mentioned, involved in very pro the Napoleonic Wars and what have you. In that period of time, you then quite nicely, in a way, you eventually move on to the Duke of Wellington, Arthur Wellesley, of course, becoming the Prime Minister. Now, there are a few bits and pieces that he is particularly known for as his time as a Prime Minister. What kind of things is he known for, and what kind of Prime Minister was he? You know, is he just one of these, is he, I almost want to liken him to, is it like the Donald Trump of his era, where he was already famous and then gets the job in spite of his fame? Or is he actually, is he a politician?
Well, probably not a very good politician. But of course, we've still got that system where, you know, it's the king that decides who the prime minister is. And if the king likes you and thinks you can do the job, then he'll appoint you. He, as you might expect, was a reactionary Tory, sat in the House of Lords, of course. One of the ultra Tories who were against any kind of reform. You know, we've been talking about the corruption in the system, the rotten boroughs, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the country was crying out for change. And of course, he is one of the leading ultras in the House of Lords, blocking, determined to block anything that might come through from the House of Commons. So, so when he was appointed, the ultras and the king and the broad mass of the Tories thought that he was their man and he would not bring in any reforms. He'd block anything. And that's why they wanted to appoint him. But surprisingly, he actually did implement change, which actually infuriated his erstwhile buddies, you know, the ultra Tories. He actually brought in Catholic emancipation, which was a big no-no for many Tories. So he felt it was necessary because the situation was getting out of control in Ireland. And he thought that was something that was necessary to be done. And also something else that helped Catholics was the Test and Corporations Act. So he passed these reforms, much to everybody's surprise. But it's interesting, of course, as Prime Minister, he found it very difficult because as a general, leading general, he's used to dishing out the orders, not having his orders discussed. So he's quite surprised that he'd say, we're going to do this, that and the other in cabinet. and the others would sit around and say, let's discuss this. I'm not sure we agree with this. So, that is very, you know, a general's not used to having his orders talked about like that. Mm. So he found that very frustrating to begin with. I suppose he slowly got used to it. But interestingly, later on, when he was out of office and we had the Great Reform Act going through, he was adamant against it, of course. And then when he thought the revolution was actually coming, he actually gave in and got fellow lords, ultra lords, to actually abstain on the important vote and allow the Great Reform Act to go through. Mm. So when he felt it was necessary for the future of the country or the well-being of the country, he actually stepped back and brought in reform, surprisingly, you know, because obviously he wasn't a natural reformer or supporter of reform.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's an interesting character. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting character, but would you say, was he a good prime minister?
No, not really. He was only in for a couple of years, not one of the greats, I think we can say.
Yeah.
But, yeah, very reactionary in his attitudes, as you might expect from a general, I suppose. I don't know. Mm. Perhaps I'm being biased there. But...
over the years, we've had some pretty pivotal moments in British history that have affected the world as well. Who would you, out of all the prime ministers you've looked at, who do you think had the most impact, either at home or abroad?
Oh, well, there have been like two or three key ones. I mean, Earl Grey, apart from giving his name to a tea, what was important for as Whig Prime Minister in the early 30s, for, of course, the Great Reform Act, which swept away all that old corruption and brought in a modern political system, modern politics that we, you know, it was the start of what we have today, really. So really important. And also, he abolished slavery throughout the British Empire, 1833. So two great things there were really important.
Hmm.
So yes, a key player. I also like, pretty much like Lloyd George, actually, in the 20th century. Not only did he kickstart the welfare state, national insurance for unemployment and sickness, that sort of thing, but also he was the man that won the war, the First World War. And he brought about a remarkable change in the munitions industry. And through just by bringing in businessmen and changing the practice and the way everything was organized. So he was pivotal, really. And of course, you know, he started the welfare state, national insurance, et cetera. And of course that helped Attlee when he came in after World War II, because he was able to build on that. And so, you know, from that, of course, we got the Cradle to the Grave, the NHS, and the welfare state. So, yes, he was a great player, really. Yeah. So there's two people there. And you, of course, you can't miss out Churchill. I mean, if you talk about war as well, then, of course, Churchill was axiomatic, really, in World War II. And also, if you forget about Churchill, that he worked alongside Lloyd George in bringing in the welfare reforms. National insurance. So he was a key player as a liberal prior to World War I. So, you know, he wasn't just a warmonger. He had other things, other, you know, feathers in his cap, shall we say, although he definitely became a Tory later on, a diehard Tory, not, you know, pretty much against a lot of reforms.
Mm.
But, yeah, a great war leader. You couldn't leave him out as, you know, a great character, great player in the 20th century.
Yeah,
wasn't he famous for saying? Wasn't Churchill famous for saying that when you're young, if you're not a liberal, you have no heart, and when you get older, if you're not a Tory, you have no brain.
Yes, he did say that. Yeah, he did say you shouldn't be afraid to switch horses if necessary. Of course, he could start off as a Tory, then liberal, then back to Tory. Yes.
I think there's one that we haven't mentioned, and I think we all would most people would know of him mainly because of his many, many times in office as Prime Minister. Of course, William Ewart Gladstone, four times as Prime Minister, the grand old man, GOM, however you want to refer to him. And there is, it's undoubtedly that, you know, it's one of the very few things that I can remember from my A-level British history class about this period of time, the late Victorian period to through to into the Edwardians and so on, that he was a good Prime Minister. There is many things that he did that has proved undoubtedly that he was, but he was a very peculiar character as well, wasn't he? He was a bit of a strange fellow.
Absolutely.
But just for our listeners, what kind of things did he get up to? You know, those good political things, but also these strange things as well.
Yes. But the thing about Gladstone, he was a man of phenomenal energy and stamina. And that's how, I mean, upon leaving office at the age of 84, you know, he was the oldest prime minister, of course, to leave office. And the oldest prime minister to start. On his administration at the age of 82. So he had lots of energy for outside interests, shall we say. One of the strange things that he did enjoy doing in his spare time was chopping down trees. I mean, these are absolutely huge trees that he'd cut down on his Howarden estate.
Mm.
And also he'd take his axe and go and visit other lordships. And cut a few of their trees down as well, just for practice. It was absolutely amazing, the energy that he had. I just put the record straight that he actually did plant quite a lot of trees as well as cutting them down. So there was a balance there.
Yeah.
But yes, and he also, of course, he had phenomenal energy in that he walked vast distances, like 30-40 miles. It's difficult to believe, but he did do it, and it's all recorded in his diaries that he walked these distances. He liked to go on holidays in Wales. He'd walk along the coast and in the mountains, and you know, phenomenal walks. But also he liked to go walking in Germany. He had a few holidays in Germany. He'd walk in the Alps there, in the Bavarian Alps. Huge. And can you imagine walking 30 miles in the Bavarian Alps? That's quite an achievement, actually.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a little strange little anecdote, which I found in the Roy Jenkins book about Gladstone, in that he said he was walking in Berchtesgaden along the river there. And he was walking there with his Führer. Now, that's hilarious because, of course, Berchtesgaden is Hitler's future haunt.
Indeed. And,
but he meant a guide. A Führer is also a guide. But the fact that he should say his work, you know, in his diary, wrote, I enjoy walking in Berchtesgaden with a Führer, is quite hilarious, really.
Yeah, it's like one of those moments of historical foreshadowing.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, famously, because he's a deeply religious man, and he wore his religion on his sleeve, and that was all, you know, during his work in government. He was religious, thinking about religious things as well. The moral religion was a moral guide for him. But also in the evenings, he was famous for going out and trying to rescue fallen ladies in the street, basically prostitutes.
Right.
And he wanted to convince them of, you know, of the error of their ways. And surprisingly, his wife approved of this. She was deeply religious as well. And he'd bring them home and they'd have meals together and they'd talk to them and, you know, trying to persuade them of the errors of their way. But what his wife didn't know was that he strayed sometimes and did naughty things that he shouldn't have done with them. But his wife didn't know about that. Although he did admit it to his son later on. But it was very dangerous. He was doing this as, you know, as party leader, prime minister and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
A few people did know about it and warn of him that it wasn't appropriate. But he just felt that that was something, as a mission in life, if you want, really, to do that. But really, it was only came out later in the 20th century that this, you know, this was going on. when his diaries were published. So, so a man with phenomenal energy, but also, as you say, an unusual private life, shall we say.
I did see somewhere when I was doing a lot of Jack the Ripper research years ago that he was considered as one of the most unlikely suspects because he was prime minister. He was wandering the streets looking after prostitutes, and there was a possibility that he might have been murdering them. But the author who wrote the book said this is incredibly unlikely.
It was the opposite. He wanted to save them, not murder them.
Absolutely.
I suppose you could think, if he couldn't save them, he'd murder them. So most unlikely, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, he had a 0 out of 10 next to his name, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, rightly so. Yeah.
So, lastly, we've covered quite a few odd facts and things.
Yeah.
What was the most bizarre one that you found during your research, or the one that most tickled you? You thought, yeah, that's got to go in.
It's about Alec Douglas Hume, Prime Minister, 1963-4. First of all, when his younger day, he liked to go butterfly hunting, but that's not so strange as his later hobby as Prime Minister as well, which was flower arranging. I just couldn't believe it when I read that. He liked to arrange roses and tulips in a vase. Generally at times of stress. And this was a hobby of his. Apparently, during World War II, he'd got spinal TB and he'd been encased in plaster for a year, which is an amazing thing to think, you know, imagine being encased like that. So he couldn't really do very much. And so he developed this hobby. And he said, if no one else to do it, so I do it. But amazing to think of a prime minister getting out the flowers and arranging them in a vase when things were getting a bit stressful. I think in the book I said that this could be the first case of mindfulness.
Self-care for prime ministers.
Better than the younger's drink the port option.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Clive, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about your book. So, obviously, your book, can you just remind us of the name, where it is, where people can get it from?
It's British Prime Ministers in 100 Facts, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and is that where can, if anyone fancies getting a copy of that?
Well, it's out on the 15th of November.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's freely available on Amazon or through Amberley Publishing.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That's fantastic. So thank you so much for joining us, Clive. It's been a really, really interesting session. Chris, thank you for co-hosting with me as well. And thank you, everyone, for listening in. And we'll see you around for the next one.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books. You can support them and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.